Welcome to the China Business Law Podcast, a show about the practice of law in China from real in-house and law firm professionals on the ground.
And today, the topic is litigation in the U.S. for Chinese companies. We are thrilled to be joined by Amiad Kushner, partner at Sidon Law Group, which is a boutique law firm in New York that specializes in complex commercial litigation, often on behalf of international clients, including Chinese clients in the U.S. Welcome, Amiad.
Thank you, Art. It's a pleasure to join you, and thank you for inviting me.
It's not a topic that I think too many people could really cover. So you are a unique guest on the show, for sure. And to get into a little bit more about your background and for the benefit of the audience, I thought we could take a couple minutes for you to just walk the audience through your story and your connection to China and Chinese clients, and just how you got to this point of your career.
Sure. So I've been practicing litigation in New York for 17 years now. I started out at Simpson Thacher and Bartlett, which is one of the major New York law firms. I was there for about 7 years. And then I was at Lowenstein Sandler for another 7 years. And for the past several years, I've been working at some boutique law firms, and I'm currently with Sidon Law Group. I sort of got interested in China practice by accident. I spent, I would say, the first 10 years or so of my career without touching China at all. And when I was at Lowenstein Sandler, my second law firm, I was looking to gain an edge, so to speak, in the race to become partner. You know, I was an associate, or counsel trying to become partner. And in order to become a partner, you needed to demonstrate that you could develop business. And I had this idea of trying to develop business from Chinese clients, because I thought that this is something that no one else was doing. And it seemed that this was sort of a niche that, you know, if I developed some expertise and contacts in this area, I would have a unique space and perhaps an edge against other people who were trying to make partner at the same time. I was lucky that one of my friends from law school was a partner at a major Chinese law firm in the New York office of that firm. And he was able to introduce me to his contacts in China and kind of get me started. And one day he referred to me my first significant case for a Chinese client. And that was around, I would say, 2011. And since that time, I've been very fortunate because I've had a fairly steady stream of China-related litigation and arbitration. And I've learned a lot along the way, and I would say become deeply fascinated by Chinese culture and with the contrasts between U.S. culture and Chinese culture as well.
Obviously, experienced that myself as well. And as for guests of audience members who've heard me on the podcast before. And it's so funny you mentioned that, because that's quite a common thread for folks who do business in China or have spent time in China or made a lot of contacts and traveled to China a lot. It usually starts by accident, you know, or a trip that was supposed to be one trip and then turned into staying for a few years or developing whole business, right, or a practice area.
Yeah, absolutely. When I first came to China, I was completely shocked it just how different everything was. I remember on my first trip to China, I was speaking at various conferences, and I viewed these conferences as essentially opportunities to gain contacts and clients. And so I as you would do in the US, you know, I would send emails to people who were registered to attend the conference. You know, this is the typical exercise that you do in the US when you're trying to develop business. When you go to a conference, you get a list of the attendees and you try to figure out who it makes sense to meet. You may know some people. If you don't know people, you try to get an introduction. And I had a list of some attendees at this conference, and I sent a bunch of emails introducing myself and received no response at all. And then I remember when I spoke, and the first city in China that I visited was Guangzhou. And I spoke at a conference in Guangzhou, and the topic, I believe, was bankruptcy litigation. And I remember that there was an extremely active Chinese audience in the room that had a lot of questions about bankruptcy litigation and were very interested to know about my experience and about how Chinese companies could protect themselves in the bankruptcy process. A very engaged audience, very, very eager to know. And I was really looking forward to meeting the attendees at the conference at the cocktail party, which followed. And I had a huge stack of business cards. And I eagerly went to the cocktail party and found that the only people at the cocktail party were Americans. And all of the Chinese audience members, you know, hundreds of them, had disappeared. And I became very interested to understand why that was, because, you know, in the US, whenever people think about going to a conference, nobody thinks about the value of the formal presentations or the agenda. People just think of the value in terms of the side meetings and the ability to interact with people in the hallways, you know, in restaurants, you know, going out for a drink with people that you otherwise wouldn't see and making that personal, you know, connection. Often, you know, sometimes with people that you know, but often with strangers or people you're meeting for the first time. But by contrast, I think in China, as I came to learn, the notion of a bunch of strangers getting together is just not something that works in mainland China. And a mere exchange of business cards with strangers has no meaning whatsoever.
That's a fair assessment. I would agree with that. Yeah, I mean, your Chinese level is at the time was probably almost non-existent, I would think, when you first started, right?
Yeah, that's right. My Chinese, by the way, is still pretty basic. Okay. But even if I was fluent in Chinese, it would probably have almost zero relevance to being retained on any particular matter.
So how would you typically get retained by a client? That's, I think, would be fascinating for the audience to hear that.
Sure. So I think maybe I'll just start as a comparison, you know, to the typical process in the US. In the US, if you have a company with litigation, there's typically an office of the general counsel that looks at different candidates, different law firms. There's a term called beauty contest, which all law firms are familiar with. You know, it means essentially a competition between various law firms that are pitching to be, you know, for a particular piece of work. And the exercise of the general counsel's office would involve comparing resumes, backgrounds of lawyers, getting recommendations from different people. And what you're trying to do is you're trying to weigh information and data about different candidates and make an objective determination based on the experience that each candidate brings to the table and try to fit a particular person or particular firm to a matter. And data is important, experience is important, track record is very important. In China, I would say that experience has relatively minimal relevance, particularly if you're getting outside of the largest state-owned enterprises, you know, private companies, or most companies, where what you're talking about is a recommendation from someone that the chairman of the Chinese company knows and trusts. It's a personal relationship of trust somewhere that matters. And I'm not talking about the relationship between the Chinese company and the lawyer. You know, so if you have, for example, a Chinese company has a litigation in the US, the Chinese company is not going to have any relationship with the US lawyer. The relationship is going to be between the Chinese company and a Chinese lawyer. And that relationship would typically be very, very longstanding. It could be many, many years. People know each other 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. And so if the chairman trusts this particular lawyer that he or she has known for 20 years, and that lawyer recommends an American lawyer, that's the end of the discussion. There's really no vetting. And most likely, based on my sense of how Chinese culture works, it's unlikely that there would even be any discussion. So, you know, the conversation might be something like, you know, the chairman might say, you know, do you know any American lawyers? And the response might be, oh, let me think about that. Oh, and then 2 days later, there is someone I know. And that's the end of the discussion.
Right.
By the way, the corollary of that is that I think in mainland China, if you're looking for a recommendation to hire someone, you're trying to find out about someone, mm-hmm. and you ask, let's say you're interested in finding out about a particular lawyer in a large law firm, and you happen to know another lawyer in that firm, and you're asking the lawyer at the firm that you know about this other lawyer in the same firm that you don't know, okay? Mm-hmm. In mainland China, it would be normal just to ask, oh, do you know this person? And if the answer is, oh, no, I don't know that person. That could be a way of saying, don't trust that person.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be the end of the conversation. So there's a whole class of arbitrations where the governing law is United States law, but the arbitration may be physically located outside the United States. And I've actually had a number of major arbitrations like that, often in Hong Kong, which is traditionally a preferred venue for Chinese companies, where the governing law is New York law or some other US law. But in terms of issues that Chinese companies are most most surprised by. I think the biggest issue relates to disclosure. I think it has cultural elements, and it also has just an unfamiliarity with the legal process in the United States. The philosophy in American litigation is that there should be very broad disclosure or discovery. And there's a presumption that each side should get access to the other side's information and data to the extent that it's material and relevant to a case. And in the United States, that has a very sort of obvious meaning. You know, what it means is that if a company in litigation has files, has emails, has information, you know, that it possesses, that information is subject to actually being disclosed and given to the other side. And this is a very common sense notion in the United States. In China, this, in my experience, this is quite shocking. The very idea that your secrets would be disclosed to the other side and that there would be no limit on this is quite shocking. In fact, I've been involved in disputes where our adversary produced emails and my client was shocked that they would actually give this up. How could they show us their emails? You know, it's like, it's just so shocking. And the other aspect of this, and I think, is really the kind of more of a cultural aspect, is that in the US, there is there's just a natural process by which events are documented. So if you have, you know, if you have, for example, an M&A transaction, you would have a series of emails going back and forth discussing, you know, the drafts of the M&A contract. You would have all kinds of deal points being talked about over email. And you'd be able to probably piece together the developments and the negotiation of a transaction just by looking at the email trail. Mm-hmm. In mainland China, you typically just wouldn't put things in writing. It's just a culture that it doesn't accept that is a necessary part of the process. And the result is that Chinese clients often just don't have any emails. You know, they may have WeChats, but the WeChats are often going to be of a very vague and general nature. Because business is so often just based on trust on verbal discussions, or even on unspoken understandings, there's just a lot less documentation.
Can I drill down on that point in particular? Because I think that's quite fascinating. I'm curious how, I can totally see what you're saying. And I'm curious how that plays in either a court or in an arbitration panel. And even within that, where, you know, if the panel or the court is in the US versus Hong Kong, which might be a little more accustomed to Chinese culture, as you said, not naturally documenting everything. And is there any presumptions about that, the fact that stuff is not documented, kind of maybe adversely?
Sure. Well, I think that from the US side, and I've seen this several times, that U.S. litigants are routinely shocked and angry at what they perceive to be the refusal of the Chinese side to produce documents, or the, you know, the hiding of documents. And they just do not believe that you could have significant transactions with no emails. And notwithstanding the fact that the United States and China have an extensive commercial relationship, you know, it's the largest bilateral trading relationship in the world. Nevertheless, you have this chasm, and even some of the most experienced U.S. companies that deal with China regularly are shocked at what actually happens in Chinese companies. And so this causes a lot of friction in the cases that I've been involved in. And there's often accusations by the American side that the Chinese must be hiding something, and that the Chinese side is not playing by the rules. But more often than not, what is happening is that the American side just doesn't understand the way business is done in China. The way that I have tried to deal with that is to try to sensitize the tribunal to the realities of Chinese culture. And in international arbitrations, where each party has the ability to select one of the arbitrators, I think it's critical, if you're representing a Chinese company, to select an arbitrator that has some familiarity with Chinese culture and the way business is done in China, because otherwise the arbitrator will simply not understand some of these issues around disclosure and other issues that are unique to Chinese culture.
That's interesting. Yeah, you would almost to be sort of a coach for the other arbitrators, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and look, I had one major arbitration in involving. I represented a Chinese company against a major U.S. company, and I could tell you that we spent a very, very long time searching for an arbitrator that had China experience. And we ultimately found one like that, but it was not easy. Most of the big names in international arbitration are Westerners who just don't have a very close understanding of China. And obviously, that's over time that will change. And I think that as time goes on, perhaps there's also maybe a little bit more of an internationalization to some extent of at least major Chinese companies. However, it still is a significant issue. And if you're representing Chinese companies, you really want to make sure you have someone with experience with China as one of the arbitrators. We actually had an arbitrator once who was fluent in Chinese. And we had a surreal scene during our evidentiary hearing where witnesses were testifying in Mandarin Chinese and occasionally cracking jokes. And this one member of the tribunal would just start laughing uncontrollably. And both of the legal teams were English speaking, were just like waiting for the translation, eagerly.
Yeah. Yeah, I would. I could see that if I was on that panel. I guess, I mean, not to plug my own Chinese ability or whatever, but I would be and conversationally have those kind of situations where I might be understanding the Chinese faster than the translation gets through, and getting the joke faster, I guess, and people looking at me wondering why I'm laughing. So understandable setup there. Is that will not necessarily be enough to change how they would go about their normal deal process, their due diligence process, their review process. In other words, working backwards, there's nothing as these clients become bigger, more global, more sophisticated, more accustomed to being sued and disputes, if that's working back in time to change any of their behavior as they get bigger and more sophisticated.
Well, I think you have to draw a distinction between Chinese companies that are established, you know, in the U.S. You know, they have offices in the U.S. They've been in the U.S. for a number of years, and Chinese companies that occasionally do business in the U.S. or just have a transaction with a U.S. counterparty that ends up in litigation. Of course, Chinese companies that are in the U.S. for a long time, you know, thinking, I'm just throwing a name out there, like, you know, Bank of China, have to adapt to U.S. regulations, they have to comply with U.S. law, and they have substantial compliance departments, and they're highly regulated. They have policies and procedures to reflect that. But I think that is a very, very small slice of the Chinese universe, if you will. I think the vast majority of Chinese companies that do business in the U.S. Are unaware of the way things are done in the U.S. and have a hard time, say, understandably. And it's only when you encounter a dispute that you start to realize how some of these differences play out in litigation or arbitration. I also think that culturally, the notion of doing business in a way that would protect you in litigation is just not, that's not a Chinese approach. That sounds like, you know, in the U.S.
No, I hear you.
You probably know exactly what I mean, because, you know, in the U.S., we just assume that litigation is part of the landscape of doing business. It's a cost of doing business. It's fairly normal. And I think U.S. companies understand that documenting things can help protect you in litigation. And litigation is just sort of expected. There are certain types of U.S. companies like banks that are sued every day of the week. Now, I think Chinese companies are very, very difficult targets to sue in the U.S. mainly because U.S. judgments are basically unenforceable in mainland China. And apart from that, there are a lot of practical difficulties of suing companies, Chinese companies that are, you know, based in mainland China, but maybe they had a transaction in the U.S. or an office in the U.S. Very often the documents are going to be in Chinese. So it's just, you know, it's burdensome to have things translated, or, you know, and then if you're trying to get discovery from mainland China, there's a special review process for state secrets. It's an extra layer of cost and burden. Takes a lot longer. The physical distance between the U.S. and China creates problems. If you have to take depositions of Chinese witnesses, and if they don't travel to the U.S., you have to travel to Asia, and you can't take depositions in mainland China. So you have to go outside of mainland China.
Right.
You know, it's just one issue after another And then you add to that the fact that, as we talked about, Chinese companies tend not to really document things.
Right.
So I think that it's very difficult to sue Chinese companies in the US in general. And most American lawyers are unaware of just how difficult it is. And they're in for a surprise.
I've heard that story as well. And I guess, but maybe you could probably make a distinction between, like you said, Chinese companies doing deals, kind of cross-border deals with US companies. And then you have maybe some of the companies, like you mentioned, Bank of China, which have been in directly invest in the US and build and operations in the US. And those, of course, then have assets that could be sued and judgment attached to in the US. But at the same time, I take it then that if they have that presence, they're already also more sophisticated about litigation in general. So they're not just an easy target in that sense.
That's right. I think the Bank of China's of the world have in many ways transformed, themselves to adapt to the US way of doing business. And I wouldn't be surprised if most of the people working at Bank of China are Americans, in their sure. US offices, as you would expect. But again, Bank of China is in the minority. Most Chinese companies just do not have that kind of presence in the US.
So can you, do you have any recommendations for let's say American companies or Chinese companies, when they're drafting sort of their dispute resolution clauses in their contracts, things to watch out for, things to get tripped up on? You mentioned, for example, that there might be an assumption that US company by US lawyers that they can easily sue a Chinese company. Is there language or things that you see that are can be critical mistakes in drafting that dispute clause?
Yeah, so if you're a US company and you're trying to protect yourself in a potential dispute with a Chinese company, you probably want to go with international arbitration rather than agreeing to a court proceeding. If you agree to a dispute resolution in a Chinese court, you're kind of at the mercy of a very unfamiliar court system, where the way the game is played is just very, very different. Among many other things, it's fairly common for Chinese litigants to have ex parte contacts with the judge. And there could be all kinds of unusual influences on the process that an American company would be shocked by. On the other hand, if you have your dispute resolved in a United States court, the US court judgment is unenforceable in China. And so it could be of very little use to you. So if you choose arbitration, the arbitration award is going to be enforceable in China, and Chinese courts overwhelmingly enforce international arbitration awards. But what you need to be very careful about is the way that you craft the arbitration clause, because Chinese law is very strict on the way that these clauses have to be drafted. And if you don't draft your clause, your arbitration clause, very carefully, you could end up having problems enforcing an arbitration award in China. There are a number of cases where Chinese courts declined to enforce international arbitration awards because there was a defect in the arbitration clause. The fact that a U.S. court judgment is completely meaningless in China creates enormous leverage. And it drives the entire case. It creates a very powerful dynamic where the American company that's suing the Chinese company knows that no matter how successful it is in the case, whatever judgment it obtains is probably going to be worthless. And so what you can do is extract very favorable settlements. Mm-hmm. You can really limit exposure. And this is, to be frank, this is unfair. And I think, you know, it's an imbalance, which should be, in all fairness, corrected. It really is not a level playing field in that sense. Mm-hmm. But at the moment, that is the situation. And if I'm on the U.S. side, if I'm in the U.S. representing a Chinese company, you know, I want to be in a U.S. court. Now, having said that, many Chinese companies prefer arbitration because it's confidential and it's perceived to be less costly. And it may or may not be less costly. Arbitrations can be very expensive, but it is confidential. And many Chinese companies are secretive, and you know, they find the confidentiality very, very attractive. So that is another important consideration. But as I said, arbitration awards are enforceable just about anywhere in the world, and so the pressure point of, you know, that you would enjoy in a U.S. court is gone in an international arbitration.
Amen, any other cultural differences? I kind of wanted to wrap up with an open-ended question of kind of some other points we haven't covered, or other kind of cultural differences or lessons you've seen over the years handling these kinds of cases, which as I mentioned at the top, you're a kind of guest that we haven't had on the show and may not have again on the show for a long time. So handling these kind of cases, any lessons or cultural differences you want to emphasize again?
Yeah, I think one thing maybe we haven't talked about is, you know, in my experience, Chinese companies tend to be extremely hierarchical places where control of decision making is typically vested in one person. You know, it could be the chairman, or it could be perhaps some powerful figure who is behind the chairman, as it were. And it's just important to understand that dynamic, because you're often dealing with people who have no real authority, including the general counsel. So you may be dealing with someone who has the title of the general counsel of a Chinese company, and that person will have absolutely no authority over the litigation. And that's really important to understand when you're dealing with Chinese companies. By contrast, in the U.S., the general counsel does have real authority, and often in a situation in which there's a bet the company litigation, the general counsel has the final say over the company's decision making in a litigation, and one would not expect the business to interfere with litigation decisions. In China, that would be unthinkable. You know, the notion that a mere functionary would sort of dictate to the chairman how a particular decision should be made based on supposed expertise in one area. It's just not the way Chinese companies work. So it's important to understand that dynamic.
That's a very good observation. right on the money. Well, thank you, Amiad. I mean, this has really been quite a pleasant experience of an area I'm less familiar with, for sure. But also, just it's been a thrill to have you on, and I think our audience on both sides, China and the U.S. and other places around the world, will benefit a lot from listening to this, because it's not, like I said, a topic that we can easily find someone with the expertise to talk about every day. So really, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure, Art. Thank you so much for inviting me to this podcast.